Hello, my name is Ben Burrell and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that takes an in-depth look into each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Thank you once again for following us on Instagram and Twitter over the last month or so. If you haven't done so already, you can find us on both those at Bob Dylan Podcast. And if you've enjoyed previous episodes and you haven't subscribed yet, feel free to click the subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts from. For this episode, we look at one of the best albums ever made, a record that feels incredibly personal, but also tackles universal themes of love, loss, acceptance, and life. I couldn't do it justice by confining this album to one episode, so I've split it into a number of parts. This is episode 6, part 1, and the album in question is Blood on the Tracks.
'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
This record is obviously a classic. Often cited as Bob's masterpiece, this has many times been called the finest collection of love songs of the 20th century. In fact, I don't think it's stretching it to call it the finest collection of love songs ever. It perfectly encapsulates those feelings of love in all its different guises, from the heady start of a relationship to its painful deterioration. The level of relatability as a listener in these songs is astonishing. There's an intimacy too, not just in the sound, but in the feeling that only you and the composer understand what's being sung about. Personally, I've always had the sense the record moves through the stages of the breakdown of a relationship over its 10 songs, starting with the initial separation on the opener Tangled Up in Blue, moving to sadness of that relationship passing in songs like Simple Twist of Fate and its succeeding track You're a Big Girl Now, to then becoming embittered during Idiot Wind, with a brief reconciliation on the song You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go, before the reality of that breakdown of that relationship hitting in Meet Me in the Morning. We then finish with resolution and acceptance on the final two songs, Shelter from the Storm and Buckets of Rain, all this with a Shaggy Dog Western story of Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts in the middle. With its running order, this album almost becomes a step-by-step guide to love coming to an end. Dylan's headspace for the record appears to have started with a New York art teacher called Norman Rayburn, who'd come recommended by Bob's friends. Rayburn appeared to have somewhat eccentric methods with his pupils and a disdain for them too. Apparently, he constantly called Dylan an idiot. Despite this, Bob went to him 5 days a week for months taking art classes, which appeared to have worked Dylan into a headspace where he was able to become a new artist and reinvent his creative process. He says, "I was constantly being intermingled with myself and all the different selves that were in there, until this one left and then that one left, and I finally got down to the one I was familiar with." This stripping back to his true self and the time he spent working in and around paintings and more visual art becomes the framework for the album opener, Tangled Up in Blue.
Early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red.
Those opening lines here are so incredible. Beginning with, early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. This does so many things at once. It gives the listener pleasure in those simple fun rhymes of bed and red, and in the next line, rough and enough. It also hooks us in like the start of a film. We're instantly wondering what's happened. Where is this woman and why is she not here and who is this person he's singing about? Then we get a little more in the succeeding lines of, her folks said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough.
Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough.
These opening lyrics, like all good writing, tell us so much in such few words. The lines remind me of a classic novel. There's just so much to read in the spaces in between. We've gleaned from the opening passages already there's been a separation. It also appears from the inevitable tone of those lines of never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough, that this has been doomed from the start, which in itself sets up the album's reoccurring theme. It also becomes clear from these lyrics that this was a breakdown of a marriage, something that wasn't a million miles away from Dylan's own personal situation. As I mentioned before, Bob's surroundings in the New York art scene helped to form the song's framework. He tried to do something he'd never done before on this particular track. He explains, "I wanted to defy time, so the story took place in the present and the past at the same time. When you look at a painting, you can only see part of it, or you can see it all together. I wanted that song to be like a painting." In the song, Dylan attempts to incorporate multiple perspectives within a single view. It's like a vast painting. We get this story played out in front of us with different things going on at different times, all within the same frame. We swerve from location to location, from period to period, as the verses pick out moments from this relationship, or even perhaps relationships. It even feels like this is confirmed in the song's title. According to novelist Ron Rosenbaum, this is a reference to Dylan becoming completely absorbed in Joni Mitchell's album Blue, and that fits this idea of the story hopping around timelines and settings. It also appears we're hearing from these characters in this universe rather than a fixed setting and a fixed narrative. This all leads to the final big idea of this song, and that is that this is a living, breathing work of art. Dylan likes to play around with the lyrics and move them away from the original cut when he performs the song live. Listen to this live version from 1984's album, Real Life.
Well, one morning the sun was shining, he was laying in bed, wondering if she changed it all, if her hair was still red.
In this version, Dylan shifts to the third person in the lyrics, singing, "Early one morning the sun was shining, he was laying in bed." We also hear there's a large age difference in this doomed relationship where the husband would go on to leave his wife penniless, revealing a little bit more information that we never heard before. I think this suggests this song is less about a particular incident or relationship, but more about a mood or that feeling of initial separation or even the period just before. In another live version at the Boston Music Hall in 1975, the character that's lying in bed has shifted to become a woman.
Early one morning the sun was shining, she was lying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. If folks they set their lives together, shoes are gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough.
Regardless of all these great little intricacies and perspectives that are found all over different versions of this track, it would appear that the basic narrative is that at the start of the song, a relationship is coming to a close, and by the end, our narrator is trying to recapture the object of his desire, especially with that last passage of, "So now I'm going back again, I've got to get to her somehow," and finishing with, "We always did feel the same, we just saw it from a different point of view, tangled up in blue." Those final lines end up becoming the perfect setup for the LP's remaining 9 tracks. Musically, the song has some different layers too. What I've always thought was underrated was the sound of this tune. Let's just have a listen to those opening bars again. It's hard to not get caught up in the lyrics of a song like this, but I think the atmosphere created by the instrumentation is an important component to the song's success. In the NME, when the album was released, Nick Kent describes the LP's sonics as so trashy they sound like mere practice takes. And I completely disagree. Sure, they may not be clean cut, but they do provide a dusty ramshackleness that creates the perfect intimate environment for the lyrics. These verses over sterile clean production would lose all sense of the personal. Lose that and you lose these songs' biggest selling point. Here we get an intimacy via the acoustic guitars from Dylan and players Chris Webber and Kevin Oldgaard. The strings of each guitar are almost in conversation, like they're birds chirping at one another, all accompanied by some deaf flicks on the hi-hat, adding a nice bit of pace to the melody.
And when it finally, the bottom fell out, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was to keep on keeping on, like a bird that flew, trying to let me blue.
Those drums really shine, especially on the final parts of each verse, kicking in and finishing again with a snappy hi-hat on that main Tangled Up in Blue line. This production, which by the way was from Dylan, gives a great sense of beginning. Anyone who's listened to this song first thing in the morning will testify to that. The sound, especially the guitars, have a journeying quality to them, something that works really well on those travelling lines. This is achieved with some very simple chord shifts on the rhythm guitar. We morph from a straight G chord to a suspended G chord, which is done by adding just a couple of fingers to the chord shape. It creates a forward motion in the sound, like a train chugging across the tracks as we go from G to suspended G. In the chorus-like ends of the verse, we have more poppy chords of D, E minor, G, and then C. That E minor helping to throw in a backdrop of dread across the big major chords, just like in the song's narrative of this relationship with its undercurrent of doom. D, E minor, G, and then C. That E minor just putting in a tiny bit of uncomfort amongst these big, happier sounding chords. It's a simple yet very effective device to employ. That feeling of impending doom is more than present on the other opening tracks on the album, especially track 2, Simple Twist of Fate, as we shift to a more sombre sound where that feeling of trying to win her back from the end of Tangled Up in Blue has all but disappeared.
They walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember well, and stopped into a strange hotel with a neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate.
Again, I love the sound of this song. You can hear just how live it is, with the squeaking of fingers moving up and down the fretboard of the guitars, as well as occasionally hearing the guitars themselves creak. I particularly enjoy how the bass jumps up and down from high to low notes, adding an extra note to texturise the sound. So for every chord we get on the acoustic guitar, the bass plays two notes, giving it a meandering, wistful feeling. Listen to its movement on the song's intro. Also, there's a nice touch of reverb on Bob's voice that really enriches his performance. Sometimes reverb is overused or utilised to cover some less than impressive vocals. Here, though, it ramps up that feeling in those lines where it really comes to the forefront, particularly where he sings, "And wished that he'd gone straight."
And wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate.
It really showcases that feeling of emptiness and loneliness that is the undercurrent of this song. Like Bob is shouting these lines into the void and we hear them echo round to no one. At the start of the track, the lyrics detail a relationship, but again, there's a sense of things coming to an end. Despite those lines of sitting together and feeling a spark, they're always caveated with lyrics tinged with regret, like "'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight." Like we're watching this relationship unfold, knowing that it's about to come to an end. The first two verses peek at the couple in their final moments together, before in verse 3 the storyline splits as the woman leaves, walking on by the arcade, with the man left in bed waking up as light bursts through a beat-up shade.
A saxophone someplace far off played, as she was walking on by the arcade, as the light bursts through a beat-up shade, where he was waking up. She dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate.
In the remaining verses, we only hear from the male character as he reminisces about this woman, even trying to find her again in verse 5 before seemingly giving up in the final verse. Again, it appears this song is subscribing to that multiple perspectives idea. Time shifts quickly throughout the tune's runtime, and also years appear to elapse, indicated by lines like, "Maybe she'll pick him out again." And in the final verse, the lyrics have gone from a third-person narrative of "he woke up" or "he hears the ticking of a clock" to a first-person narrative with lines like, "I still believe she was my twin." It appears our narrator has been reminiscing in previous verses to finally, in the final verse, speaking from the present day, wrapping up the story. This gives us the impression it was so long ago the narrator felt like a different person, or that he's been kidding us that this was a tale of fiction, only to announce at the end that it actually happened to him. This shift really gives those final lyrics a weight and power, highlighting once again that this relationship is now long gone. What I particularly like about the final lines in this song and on this album generally is how it never gets self-pitying or overdramatic. There's a sense that Dylan is talking from the heart and not dressing it up too much, like he's bearing his soul rather than crying on someone's shoulder. This is something that peaks towards the end of the album with the analytical, "that was that, things happened" feeling of Buckets of Rain.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
These unself-pitying songs were amongst Dylan's best, and it's a good job too. It was important this record was a success. Arguably, from the start of his career to 1969, with hindsight, Bob had hardly put a foot wrong with albums. Of course, some were better received than others, but none could be described as a dud, and there was a healthy classic-to-album ratio in there too. Here, though, for the first time in his career, that was quite different. The self-destructive self-portrait and the slightly muted existence of New Morning had set a precedent that couldn't even be saved by Pat Barrett and Billy the Kid's classic Knocking on Heaven's Door. As usual for Bob, though, the comeback was emotion. The preceding album, Planet Waves, did a decent job of helping to turn that tide and pave the way for Blood on the Tracks, and the resulting tour had been a successful one, although it does sound gruelling, and Dylan is quoted on saying how much of a slog it was for a multitude of reasons. By this time, Bob had also come back to the Columbia label. Having previously released a couple of albums via Asylum Records, this was a return to the big time with regards to commercial muscle. Because Planet Waves had delivered Bob's first ever number one album, there was more than a feeling the time was right to strike commercially, so it makes perfect sense for him to return to his former home, especially after the bad blood of the 1973 Dylan album, which had been a revenge record from Columbia, issuing it without Bob's input and containing no Dylan originals, appears to have been put to bed. They tied Bob into a three-album deal that would be hugely fertile for all involved. Taking care of the business side of things comes at an interesting time for Bob personally. His relationship with his wife Sarah was at a crossroads, and he acquired another woman in his life in the form of Ellen Bernstein, who appears to inspire track 5, You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go.
I've seen love go by my door. It's never been this close before. Never been so easy or so slow. I've been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it's wrong. You're gonna make me lonesome. When you go.
Ellen had been working for Columbia in the A&R office in San Francisco, and she'd met Dylan through the label. She tells a story of a night they spent together early in their relationship playing backgammon, where she describes Bob as being funny and charming. She was also with Dylan during the early stages of the album's composition. The record was largely written during a summer on Dylan's Minnesota farm, and Bernstein remembers his process. She says, he would do his writing early in the morning and then kind of materialise around midday. He'd come downstairs and eventually during the day share what he'd written. It was all in the notebook and then he would play it and ask what I thought. It was always different every single time. He would just change it, change it, change it. You definitely got the sense his mind never stopped. Elsewhere in her quotes, she paints the picture of a happy domesticated artist, which is interesting given this album's themes. And again, there's definitely a juxtaposition between the album's environment and its subject matter. There's a feeling of good timing at its inception. Dylan had had a bit of success, was now back on his home label, had experiences to talk about, and a new muse. This record of Love and Loss actually came at a pretty decent time. All he had to do now was to capture these songs in the studio, and that would come with some complications. Something we look at in detail in part two. Thanks for listening to this episode. Hope you enjoyed. I've got to say, listening to this album from start to finish has been an absolute joy. I don't know about you, but I haven't sat down and played the first song and stayed to the last song and given it my undivided attention for quite a while. And you kind of take it for granted, an album like this, don't you? When you've listened to it for so long and when you've loved it and you've heard it so many times, that you kind of forget just how good it is until you actually physically sit down and really pay attention. This still stands up as an incredible piece of work, and I'm really looking forward to the next couple of parts of this episode. Speaking of which, on the next part, we are going to look at the next two songs on the album and also the album's recording process, including the New York sessions and some of those songs that were dropped from those New York sessions. In the meantime, if you could subscribe to the podcast, if you haven't done so already, that really helps us out. And what helps us out even more is if you give us a rating, 5 stars or 4 stars would be great. Don't go any lower. I mean, if you're thinking about giving a 2 or a 3 star, don't bother, especially not if it's a 1 star. Just don't do it. Instead, 5 or 4s, that'd be great. Thank you very much for doing that, and until next week, goodbye.